macroeconomics with chapter 23, section 1. So the big idea here is that free enterprise is the freedom of individuals and businesses to operate and compete with a minimum of government interference and regulation. You know, so once more back to this idea of Adam Smith, that the invisible hand, the capitalism is a self-regulating system. In many ways, we still operate off of that same theory. And so some of the terms you'll see, private good versus public good, externality, meaning things that we try to account for. We'll talk about government interference in terms of antitrust laws and how monopolies were dealt with. And so even though we do operate in a free enterprise system, there are government regulations on that system. Now, the first question I want to ask is, does the government do a good job protecting private citizens from the negative effects of products? And again, it's an academic question that I just want you to consider as we're learning about this lesson. You know, is this something that we do a good job with? Is this something that voting someone else into office could change? Are the two classic theories of economics in terms of invisible hand versus government regulation, which do you lean toward when it comes to private? And so first let's look at public goods, you know, like roads or even gas from a certain point of view. So public goods versus private. Now, if I'm a business and I'm making bread, I'm spending my own money to buy the flour, I'm using my own time to make the bread on a property that I personally own, a store or whatnot, and I'm making bread. It's a private good that I'm offering and selling, and you may choose or not to buy the product. And when it is consumed, say if I sell a loaf of bread to Jamie, and he eats the loaf of bread, it's done. He is the end user. He can buy that loaf of bread, and he can throw it on the street. I mean, sure, he'll hurt my feelings, but whatever. It's his bread. He can do whatever he wants with it. He can feed it to a dog. He can eat it. He can make it into a pizza. It's his business. He's the end user, and it cannot be consumed by another. He can't eat it and then resell it. That'd just be gross. And another type of good is called a public good. And a public good is an economic good that is consumed collectively. You know, roads are the classic example here. Say you're going to go to Asheville this afternoon, watch a movie, or go out to eat, or walk around the town and go shopping. You're going to drive on I-26. Interstate 26 has garnered attention at the national level. There are folks in Washington, D.C. right now trying to think about how to facilitate traffic along I-26. There have been millions of dollars of public resources, perhaps billions at this point, spent on that interstate that you can go and get on 5 minutes from here and complain about the traffic and pay nothing to use. And yet there are folks at the highest levels of transportation in our government that are thinking about that very road right now that will cost you nothing to use. That's a public good that you can use, you cannot use. Personally, I like to avoid 26 when I can. And then again, national defense. You know, another of the classic examples of a public good. The fact that you can drive on said road and assume a relative degree of safety and peace. That, you know, Nazi zombies aren't going to be dropping out of planes and attacking you with whatever Nazi zombies use to attack you. I mean, you can live in relative comfort and peace and security thanks to our national defense. Now, examples. Private goods consumed once. And here's the thing. If I get on 26, I don't have to pay a dime. Now, granted, I got to pay for the car and the gas, et cetera, but in terms of using the road, it costs me nothing. But in terms of the bread, if I walk into Baker Bills and I want to buy a loaf of bread, he's not just going to give me a loaf of bread if I make a puppy dog face. You can't run a business off puppy dog faces. Now, granted, it might work once. You might go, okay, whatever. But it's not a sustainable way to do business. And so if I'm unwilling to pay, I don't get bread. We all understand that. It's a private good. Food is a great example. You know, I bought pizza yesterday for the family. If I hadn't have gone by Domino's and bought said pizza, well, then I wouldn't have bought pizza. So clothes are another example. Clothes, of course, can be resold. You know, Ashley loves buying clothes for Avery, so she bought him some cute boots. I was like, really? Does he need boots right now? But she wanted to buy him boots, so bought him boots. And the idea is that we're going to resell them. Well, it's our business. If she wanted to buy said boots and then throw them in the trash, that'd be wasteful. But hey, that's her right to do so. You know, again, it's a private good. Private services. Yeah, I mean, when I get my hair cut, I could, in theory, choose to never get a haircut. Well, the way my hair works, that would just get weird. But yeah, I mean, I could choose to never get a haircut. I'm going to eventually get one. I'm always lazy about it, but probably next week or so. Insurance. Another great example. Now, if you're going to drive a car, by law, you're required to purchase insurance. You have to, because if you hit someone else's vehicle and you have no way to pay, that hurts them. So if you're going to drive, by law, again, you have to buy it, but it's still a private good. Medical services. In theory, it's the same way. I mean, I could have chosen not to get my shoulder worked on. I'm glad I did, because now I'm getting better instead of progressively worse over time. But once more, it was a private decision that I had to make. Public good. These are goods shared by everyone. These are also goods the government provides. You know, many of you guys hit these examples. Libraries. Roads. You know, and I was thinking of libraries more of a service, but honestly, like, you could also think about it as a good in that it's a building. You use it. Books are certainly a good that once more being used by the public. A park is a good. It's a space that was built that required capital, and now everyone can use it. Street lights, museums even. And how are these paid for? They're paid for by taxes. By you guys choosing to get good jobs, and in those jobs being required by law to pay taxes that provide for these public goods. Now, public goods produce externalities. These are unintended side effects. There can be good side effects. There can be bad side effects. And these can affect even people not involved. So, for example, roads provide a positive externality. Not only does the highway make it easier for you to get from place to place, it also makes the goods in the stores that we shop in cheaper, because the cost of shipping is directly related to the price of goods in a store. You ever thought about it this way? Anybody been up to the boondocks? Like, my mother-in-law lives in Cashiers. We were up there for the holidays. And if you had to guess, would the price of gas be cheaper or more expensive in Cashiers? Yeah, because it's harder to get there. Gas is more expensive. Because if you go to Cashiers, you got to go on this windy road. I mean, it takes an hour from Brevard to get up there. It's a long ways up. And it's not near any interstate. It's at, well, I mean, the base elevation is 4,000 feet for a town. It's way up there. And so, yeah, I mean, because the cost of shipping is higher, the cost of goods in their stores is higher. We're right by the interstate. So, say you go get gas at Ingalls and Flat Rock, which is where I go a lot, that's about as cheap as you're going to find in this area. Why? Because it's right by the interstate. Okay, that's a positive externality for us in terms of transportation. Now, examples of public goods we talked about. Secondly, what role does government play in ensuring competition? You see, the government's actively involved in trying to protect us, not just from Nazi zombies or North Koreans or whatever, but they also try to protect us economically by making businesses play fair. So we've learned from American history that a monopoly is when an industry, when a company becomes the sole provider of that good or service, and they control that market. So what can the government do? Well, they can pass laws to try to preserve competition. You see, a monopoly represents the end of competition. If you're the only business providing that good or service, well, then you have no competition. And so if we can pass a law banning that type of business, then hopefully we can preserve the competition. And so the example that was given earlier was the Sherman Antitrust Act, passed in 1890, because the theory is that monopolies hurt competition. And capitalism is based on the idea that if there's more than one company making said product, it's going to inspire innovation, it's going to lead to competitive pricing, and it's going to be better for us, the consumer. And so we want competition. And so with mergers, the lack of competition allowed businesses holding the monopoly to charge any price they wanted. You know, for example, if there was only one company making laptops, that would really suck because they could charge theoretically whatever they wanted. And so instead of these Chromebooks that you guys use that were produced to be the cheaper alternative to expensive laptops, you would just have one company and they could continue to charge $1,300 for a laptop, and you would either have one or you wouldn't. And so, of course, we know that monopolies represent a threat to competition. So, here's where I want to get a little more academic. You see, we are in a country that encourages free enterprise, but we are also in a country that places regulation on businesses. And we are also in a country where the government owns a number of very large businesses and provides a monopoly on those services. For example, natural gas, water. If you live in the city limits, water is a monopoly provided to you by the good folks of Henderson County, as is your sewage, as is your garbage. Those are public utilities. Even in many places, electricity. Because, for example, if you lived up in Cashiers in 1930, there was no electricity. Why? Because it didn't make economic sense for anybody in their right mind to provide electricity for Cashiers in 1930. Why? Because there were like 10 people up there. Okay, I'm exaggerating. Maybe 100 people lived in Cashiers at that time. And it's just not worth it for any company to build a power plant for 100 daggone people. So the government monopolized electricity since everyone uses it, and it made sense. And so electricity was provided during the Great Depression through a law called the Rural Electrification Act to Cashiers. And so while it was too expensive to justify up there, there were plenty of power companies providing power down here because there were more people. But we all equally use electricity. And so, of course, now the academic question is, it's not even academic, it's a practical one. Should healthcare be considered a public utility? You know, that's where the universal payer thing comes in. Area where government regulation is key. So, we still believe in the idea that business is self-regulating. That if you make bad bread, no one buys it, you go out of business. And that's really good for everyone because you want companies to be motivated to make good bread. But we also have regulations. For example, the Food and Drug Administration. They require that companies put accurate labels on their food. You don't want to buy something that says it's one thing and is actually another. That's unsafe. And so, as you know, products can be recalled. You know, right now we're dealing with a massive nationwide recall of romaine lettuce. And as you know, it would be illegal for any store or restaurant to serve romaine lettuce. It would actually be illegal. And as a result, you know, you're discouraged from buying romaine lettuce. If you eat it and die, that's on you. But if a company claims that it's not romaine lettuce, and then you eat it and die, that's on them. So again, they are required by law to publicly disclose whatever it is they're selling. So lastly, can a company that holds a monopoly really benefit? I mean, you know, electricity is an example of government monopoly. Water, sewage, gas, power, etc. So those are public utilities. Now again, private monopolies historically have shown to be bad, but there are cases where the government holds a public monopoly. Section 2 is all about economic systems. And I know that's not the most exciting thing, but what you have to understand is that economic systems are the way that society organizes the production and the consumption of all goods and services. And so we're thinking big picture here with macroeconomics. So organizing the production and consumption of all goods. And so a few terms you'll see here, such as real GDP, business cycle, labor force, unemployment, fiscal policy, inflation, consumer price index. So a lot of big loaded terms here. So bear with me. And the first question I ask is recessions. You guys were very young when the last recession occurred. In 2007, the economy stood on the brink of collapse. And there's a really neat movie about the recession. It's an economic movie. It was very well done. I'll have to point you guys to it. We might watch some clips before too long. And it traces why that major recession occurred. But what I want to also help you understand is that recessions are part of a normal business cycle. Is that right now in Henderson County, we are experiencing a small recession. The summer boom is over. The tourists have gone back to wherever the warm places are, the big cities. And the leaves are off the trees, and we're about to start getting snow. So the tourist season is over in Henderson County, so we've gone into a bit of a recession. And you know what? It's perfectly normal. Business is down, there's fewer people in the restaurants and the stores, and it's perfectly normal. Why? Because that's how the business cycle of Henderson County works. And the businesses of Henderson County are very well prepared for that. They make most of their money during the summer season, and then they go into, let's say, a bit of housekeeping. You know, they'll focus on, yeah, they do with the leaf season too. And so those are normal business cycles. And so right now they're focused on administrative stuff, figuring out their budgets for the next year, and largely living off of what they made in the summer. And so what I also want to help you understand is that's a business cycle. We're in a recession right now in Henderson County, but it's perfectly normal because we're very well prepared for it. But recessions on the big scale are also a fairly normal part of the business cycle. When I was in high school in the 90s, we were experiencing one of the strongest economic booms in the past 100 years. It's hard to describe. You know, if, when I say $5 bought me a movie, you have to remember that was really only 20 years ago. And when I said that minimum wage got me a vehicle, you have to understand that was only 20 years ago. That a minimum wage job got me a vehicle that I could call my own. And you also have to realize that I could have, in theory, paid my way through college. And that was only 20 years ago. It would have been more difficult at that time, but it was even easier when my dad was in college. Now, it wasn't realistic when his dad was in college. So there's about a generational period where the economy was much stronger than what it is now. And so part of that is in due to the economic downturns that occurred that are a part of a normal business cycle that had we been more prepared for, perhaps we could have planned for it. So a few terms that I need to help you understand. First is the real gross domestic product. This is the most accurate measure of a country's. So what is a real GDP? This is an economy's production after we figure out the distortions of price increases. You know, when I talk about the economy of my youth, I try not to use numbers. Because when I say that I bought a truck for $2,000, it doesn't translate. When I say that I afforded said truck off a job that paid $5.15 an hour that I was content with, it doesn't translate. Because again, when you think of the real GDP, I need to explain the buying power of said $5 an hour. I need to help you understand the actual worth of the truck that I only paid $2,000 for. Because in theory, you could afford a vehicle for $2,000 working a summer job now. But you're less likely to find a good vehicle for $2,000 right now, which is how the real GDP works. So economists measure periods of growth and decline. Okay, so back to a couple previous chapters. GDP is just the total value of all goods and services and the value of all the things made in this country in a year. It's a big, giant number. Again, it feels very esoteric. So here's where it gets even more confusing. The increase in price raises GDP. So if Apple makes the iPhone more expensive, that actually raises the GDP of our country. But it doesn't actually grow the economy. Apple charging more for the iPhone doesn't help you. Granted, we can write that on gains and losses as part of our growth in GDP. But the real GDP removes these distortions. It accounts for that. What you need to understand is the business cycle. These are alternating periods of growth and decline that the economy go through. And it's relatively normal. For example, during the dot-com era when the internet was relatively new, I remember when Amazon started in the late 90s, Google started in the late 90s, all of these businesses were going online for the very first time. And that was part of why the 90s were such a strong period of economic growth. But it was immediately followed by the early 2000s. It was called the dot-com burst, where so many of those businesses started with really bad ideas, and they went bankrupt. You know, so many of them went out. You know, the early experiments with social media, many of them were failures. Many of the email platforms that started up in the 90s were failures. You know, for example, my first email account was Hotmail. My first social media was MySpace. The early version of Tinder was hotornot.com. Yeah. I mean, and so many of those businesses went under. And you've probably heard of some of those. There were far more. And so many of them failed. And guess what? That's a normal part of the business cycle. Because for every Bailey Foster that becomes the next famous knitter, there's far more that fail. There's far more that fail than there are that succeed. And so when we measure that on the big scale, again, that's just part of the normal business cycle. Okay, so do you agree that price increases can be a good way for businesses to succeed in times of economic decline? And this is another tricky question. You know, if a business is losing money, what can they do? Well, they can raise prices in theory. But as we know, price is the biggest control in terms of demand. So they might also shoot themselves in the foot by doing that. And so GM, for example, is cutting costs by laying off workers. So the next part here, the economy goes through periods of growth and decline. Now, if the real GDP is up, that means expansion. That means the late 90s. When times are good, gas is cheap, life is simple. But if real GDP goes down, and here's the measure. If real GDP is in decline for 6 months or more in a row, that's called a recession. That's all it is real GDP is in decline for 6 months in a row or more. Most recessions only last about a year. During this time, many people lose jobs because the natural thing for a business to do is to cut cost when profits are down. And one of the simplest ways to cut cost is to reduce the labor force. So, in terms of education, schools were forced to do this by reducing staff through attrition. When a teacher would leave, they wouldn't replace that position. Teacher pay was also frozen during the recession. The idea there was that by not incentivizing labor will leave. We can reduce our workforce without having to fire people, because firing people actually costs money. And so when recessions occur, people lose jobs. Okay, so the civilian labor force. This is also a number that economists measure. This is all civilians, all non-military people who are of working age, who are either working or who are looking for work. So that's a number we measure, because it also helps us to come up with the unemployment rate. And the unemployment rate is the percentage of people in the civilian labor force. If you're not 16 yet, we're not measuring you as part of the civilian labor force, because even though in theory as a 15-year-old you could work, you're still not accounted in that. So the percentage of people in the labor force who are not working but who are looking for jobs. So that's actually a very complicated number to arrive at. But the reason it's worth the effort is because we think about the impact of unemployment. So here's where, you know, I got to make my plug. I want you to get good jobs. I want you to make lots of money. That's great for you, but that's also great for me. Well, yeah, in theory. And here's how I want to explain that. If we can drop the unemployment rate by just 1%, we get twice that back in economic growth. If we can drop the economic rate, with the unemployment rate, just by 1%, we get twice that back in economic growth. Because what are you going to do if you get a sweet job? Awesome, you're going to buy all the cool stuff. Well, great, the people who make all the cool stuff say thank you. And the people who work for the people who make all the cool stuff say thank you. And you're going to pay taxes on said cool stuff, both in income tax, state and federal, and in sales tax. And guess what? Yeah, I mean, my job's paid through that. And so economic growth is tied closely to employment. Now, changes in government spending or taxes. This is called fiscal policy. We've learned about this in several different places. You know, how at the local level we have to figure out how we're going to make money and how we're going to spend money ultimately. And then on the national level, the federal government uses fiscal policy to figure out how much money to spend, how much money to collect in taxes. Of course, politics has a lot to do with this. You know, that decision to cap the state income tax was a very political decision. And you were here when I asked the politicians why. And they gave their politically motivated views on why. Another term you need to understand is inflation. We talked about this a little bit already, but inflation is the sustained increase in the level of prices. And on one measure, it's a good thing. Movie prices are going up because people are able to pay more. That means, you know, again, and they're selling for what they can. So movie prices are going up because people are able to pay more. People are able to pay more because they have more money. Now, how do we measure inflation? This is measured through the Consumer Price Index. This is the measure of change in price over time of specific group of goods and services. So if we're just looking at movie tickets and you wanted to know the Consumer Price Index, well, then you would need to go back in time and look at the price of the movie ticket from 1998 to 99 to 2001, etc., every year, and you can chart that, and that gives you the Consumer Price Index. How has inflation affected movie ticket prices over the past 20 years? And you can get an accurate measure of CPI. And this is how you measure inflation. Now, you would do that over multiple different variables. So you don't just want to look at movie tickets, because maybe that's just a fluke. Maybe movies have gotten more expensive because of the, you know, crazy huge budgets of awesome movies that we go see today. You know, relative to, say, if you watch Gone with the Wind, which was the blockbuster of the 1930s, their budget, even adjusted for inflation, is itty-bitty. And so there's a couple things about this. Number one, the more variables you start to plug into the equation, the better a picture you get about how inflation affects us. But it also can start to make you think, what if I can predict this? You know, an economist are looking at trends, right? They're looking at not just movie tickets, but as many variables as they can. Big, giant spreadsheets. And so they begin to speculate, based on the trends, what are the prices of movie tickets going to be next year? Now, here's the thing. If you had some insider knowledge that movie tickets were going to double in the next year, that could lead you to invest in theaters, because suddenly they're about to make a lot more money. So if you begin to speculate, though, there's a downside to this, because if everybody invests, it causes a bubble. And this is the exact problem that happened with the dot-com era. I mean, if you go back and like look at old archived sites of hotornot.com, it was really dumb. It was a primitive version of Tinder, though. And it was an attempt. Granted, a primitive one, where Tinder was maybe more successful. But it caused speculation. People were like, whoa, the internet's the next big thing. People are going to meet exclusively online someday, and human interaction is going to diminish, and to a degree it has, but not to the degree that speculators predicted, and not as quickly as speculators predicted. While people rush to invest because of speculation, it actually hurt the market, and it burst, and that was the cause of that particular recession. In 2007, it was over housing, and I'm not going to go into that for time's sake, but similar problem. Okay, so how can a government lower inflation? There's various ways, but in general, if you've got too much money in the economy, that's going to cause inflation. And so you can actually, the government does have a control over this. They can restrict inflation by reducing the money supply. And one of the simplest ways they do that is raising interest rates, which means people are going to borrow less money, which means there's going to be less money floating around the economy. Now, the stock market. Stock markets are also an indicator of economic health. Stocks are pieces of corporations. And when we're looking at stock growth or decline, what we're talking about is profits in the form of dividends and capital gains. So if you buy stock in Sony, and Sony comes out with a new PS5 and it's the game changer, it makes all other video games dumb and people only buy PS5. Well, that was a solid investment. So you have stock in Sony. Yay, they've just crushed all the competition. They made just the next best thing. And so you're going to get dividends from that. Meaning, so you spend $100 in stock, they just grew by 10%, you're getting a check for $10 every single month. So you're getting a portion of that back. 10% on your investment return every month. Pretty good. Now, the stock value is determined by supply and demand. If they come out with a PS5 and it's a flop, well, that sucks. You actually lose money. Your $100 turns into 90 or 80 or etc. And on the big scale, that affect things. And just like the consumer price index, just like inflation, just like employment, these things can be tracked and they can be analyzed. And the more you know about them, the better off you're going to be. And so all of the stocks in this entire country are accounted for through different measures of the stock index. So there's the Dow Jones Industrial Average. There's the Standards and Poor's. These are two of the biggest measures. There's the NASDAQ, which we'll get to, which is the technology sector. So the Dow Jones Industrial Average looks at 30 key stocks. You know, 30 different types of industries to try to get a representation of how the stock market is working. Standards and Poor's just looks at the Fortune 500. There's the New York Stock Exchange. That's where stocks are bought and sold. I'm sure you've seen that in movies or on television. There's also the NASDAQ, which is the electronic index. That is how technology is doing. Sony would be measured into the NASDAQ. Now, you can also watch the trends. And there's two terms that you need to understand here. A bull market means that investors are optimistic. This means it's a buyer's market. You're buying, you're buying, you're buying. And the prices of stocks are going up and up and up and up. And then there's also a bear market. This means that investors are pessimistic. And this could be cause of speculation. You know, maybe you read an article that the PS5 is going to be dumb. That's going to suck. It's going to be so lame. You know, there's no Red Dead 3. Sorry. I mean, they're just not going to invest in it. Why? Because it's going to be lame. And as a result, investors are selling off their Sony stocks. Now, that's just one isolated incident. It wouldn't be, it'd be barely a blip on the NASDAQ radar. But if suddenly we learn, for whatever reason, you guys ever hear about the Atari, what was it called? The video game collapse of the late 80s? You have heard about that? So, yeah, for whatever reason, so the original Atari was awesome. They tried to outdo themselves with the next model, and it was a colossal failure. I forget what it was called, but anyway, the first Atari was awesome. I actually had the first Atari. The second Atari sucked really hard. And because of that, because the industry was so new, people were giving up on video games. In fact, when Nintendo came out with the Nintendo Entertainment System, the big game changer in video games that got them back on the map, they had to market it as a toy, not as a video game system. And so they sold it with this robot. I can't remember the robot's name. But they actually put the picture of the robot on the box instead of the Nintendo, because the industry was in such disarray. The fact is that the video game market in the late 80s was a bear market. Investors were very pessimistic. I think the robot's name was Robbie, if I remember. And once more, the basic concept here in Chapter 23, Section 3, that the purpose of government is to establish order, to provide security, But then finally, there are common goals that we can work together and accomplish as a community. Question I want to ask is it fair for some people to be extremely wealthy while others are impoverished? And of course, you know, my opinion, I suppose, is that it's not. It's not fair for this to be the case. But then I also have to qualify that by saying nowhere in the Constitution does it promise a fair society. And so fairness is not something that is guaranteed, but yet this problem still bothers us. And it should. As we talk about income inequality, I'm going to look at a few large trends. How do you measure income inequality? How do you differentiate certain populations to predict, which is scary, to predict outcomes? Once upon a time, there was a test called the Bregenz-K. And it's not administered nationwide. It's probably specific to several states. But states used to use this test called the Bregenz-K. And it was given when students were in kindergarten. And it was such a reliable indicator of future success that prisons based their capital outlay projects on the pass rates of that test that students were taking in kindergarten. And so when prisons would make their long-term building projects, like, okay, how many inmates do we need to predict for in 20 years? They would look at that score of what students were taking in kindergarten. And that was the most reliable, I mean, that's the data they used to approve multi-million dollar building projects. And it was reliable. Why? Well, let's see. So as we're talking about income is heavily influenced. Like any of these other economic factors, it can be measured, it can be quantified, and to a degree, it can be predicted. Now, how do economists predict someone's future income? It's scary, right? I guess the science of economics is in some ways predicting the future. So how do we do that when it comes to income? Well, there's a couple of factors we need to look at. Number one, your level of education. Now, like we talked about the other day, it's no longer as reliable of an indicator. But yet still, if you were to measure the wealthiest counties in North Carolina, and you were to correlate that data with the percentage of those in those populations who had achieved a college degree, bachelor's or higher, it's going to be a much higher percentage than those if you were to look at the poorest counties in North Carolina and look at only that one other measure. You will see a strong correlation, meaning that the richer counties have higher levels of educational attainment than do the poorer counties. Now, there's a classic economic and scientific term that you need to understand. Correlation does not equal causation. One is not the cause of the other, yet the two appear side by side. Does that make sense? So education has a strong correlation with income. And secondly, again, college graduates do have a higher earning potential than non-college graduates, though there are many lucrative trade-based jobs. When I get grumpy as a teacher, I think, man, I should learn to be a welder. I could make twice as much money. Granted, it's a high-skilled and dangerous job, but sometimes I think, you know, I think that's something I could learn and enjoy, and I could make a lot more money. So it's not an exact rule, but once more, there's a strong correlation. Education is not the only variable, however. We also have to measure family wealth. Family wealth. How your family does economically is once more a strong predictor of how you will do economically. I don't mean that to discourage you. This entire school is dedicated, devoted to the idea of breaking the cycle of poverty. You chose to come to this school to be the exception. And some of you maybe even chose to come to this school to not turn out like your family. But here's the reality. If that's your situation, the odds are stacked against you. Life didn't throw you any favors. And you need to understand that if you want to overcome that. Lastly, discrimination. Discrimination. Again, economists look at these things in very cold terms. And what we have to understand, and we have to look at this coldly and dispassionately, but also consider the human element, that if you are an ethnic or racial minority, those populations experience higher levels of poverty and unemployment, underemployment, than do Caucasian Americans. Why is that? Again, correlation is not causation. But what you need to understand is that is a reality. Now, the best general explanation I can give you for that is what we learned in American history, is that when you discriminate, when you disparage an entire population of people for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years, what do you expect? You're just going to take the chains off and they're going to go be rocket scientists? That you take the chains off and that people don't need help? That you can treat someone like dirt for hundreds of years? And even what you have to understand is there is past discrimination and there's present discrimination. And of course, we've talked about that to a great degree in these courses as well. So we talked about minorities. But even your gender can be a determinant in your economic outcome. Even your gender can be a determinant in your economic outcome. You know, I really want to be careful here when I'm talking about this stuff, because once more I want to tell you that correlation does not equal causation. You're not likely to turn out a certain way because of your gender, because of your race, because of your socioeconomic status. But there's a strong correlation. Now, why? When it comes to women and minorities, promotions, historically, have been more seldom. How do we measure this? Well, we look at managers in the private sector. On the census, we ask them, the big census that happens every 10 years that's coming out in 2020 that you can actually get a pretty sweet summer job working for. On the census, we say, what is your occupation? What is your level of income? Pretty easy to get at, you know, how high are you in this company? Fewer promotions. Lower salaries. Again, we're measuring this across a broad spectrum. But as you know, even today, women are earning about, having to guess the number, I want to say 89 cents on the dollar. If I remember correctly, it's somewhere close to that. Now, how do we combat this? Do we shrug our shoulders and say, well, that's the world, it's not fair, sucks, but, well, that's life? Some have said that, sure. There are plenty that just say, well, that's life, shrug my shoulders and move on. You know, the Booker T. Washingtons, the cast down your buckets. But there are others who have fought this, the Du Bois, and won many significant victories, such as the Equal Pay Act of 1963, requires by law that men and women and those of any race, ethnicity, or gender are paid the same by law. But what we've also seen is that a law like this can be very difficult to enforce. But again, the law is a starting place. It gives us the legislative basis for movement. Civil Rights Act of 1964, one of my favorite laws in all of American history, prohibits discrimination in a very broad way on the basis of race, religion, ethnic origin, or anything. Again, it's a very broad, encompassing law. But there's an inherent weakness to the law. Is it puts the burden of accountability on the victim. If you're discriminated against because of your race, because of your ethnic origin, because of your gender, because of your sexual orientation, because of your religion, and you never report it, is there a big brother out there looking out for you, watching and reporting on your behalf? There's not. And so the law is beautiful, but it still requires action. And yes, there's also the Americans with Disabilities Act. And laws like this are why any videos that I publish, YouTube now transcribes them automatically. It's pretty cool. Because by law, I'm required that if I publish an educational video for this class, it has to have a transcription. And so, in compliance with the Americans with Disabilities Act. Because it wouldn't be fair for me to publish an instructional video that could be used as a tool if it can only be accessed by those with hearing. And so by law, and again, thankfully YouTube has the capability that does that automatically. But the Americans with Disabilities Act goes a lot further. In fact, we have an entire department here at Blue Ridge Community College. The Director of Disability Services has a full-time job to ensure that any students on this campus with a disability have equal access to education. And again, the courts help enforce this. The process would start with the victim. So if ever you do feel discriminated against, if ever you do feel that your pay is unequal, again, the burden of accusation starts with you, but the courts are there to help. Now, what I also want to help you understand is the world is not fair. And maybe there are legitimate reasons why two people of equal education status should be paid differently. Okay, and so moving on. The topic of poverty is obviously a major problem in our country. And I want to help you understand that the government has created programs to help the poor. There are many. There are federal programs, there are local programs that we discussed. And many of these aim to incentivize self-improvement. Self-improvement. Education, for example. You're all in the same room, but you're all receiving a different quality of education. Some of you are motivated and learning and absorbing and growing. Some of you are not. The system incentivizes self-improvement. You'll get out of this class, you'll get out of any of your classes, what you put into it. So if all you get out of this class is a feeling of self-pity, well then you're going to grow greatly in the feeling of self-pity. But if you motivate and you work hard, then you might get something out of this class beyond what I had even intended. And you can use this school as a tool, as a launching pad to your next step. Or you can view this school as a prison, a place where you bide your time until you're done. That choice is up to you. Again, we provide the equal opportunity. In fact, that's the wording of the law that created high schools, Equal Opportunity Act. It's an opportunity. It's not an outcome. And so I digress, but the idea is that these programs are aimed to help you lift yourself out of poverty. And that's a very complex situation. So, how do we determine who is eligible for which programs? Well, that's a case-by-case basis. I can go into the school's rubric a little bit. So, when you applied to come to this school, you were one of about, I remember your group, there were about 118 of you guys who all applied to come to this school. Roughly 44 of you got in. I don't remember the exact numbers of your freshman class, but I think it was about 44. So that means most of the students that applied did not get in, but you guys were some of the lucky few. So how did we pick you versus someone else who maybe applied but did not get in? Well, let me go into that a little bit. I don't want to get too specific with it because that's privileged information. But half of the rubric is your academic ability, meaning will you be successful at the college? Can you do this, basically? We look at test scores, we look at your grades, we look at teacher recommendations. The other half is what we call economic need. You know, if your family, 80% of our student population has to fit that definition of economic need. And that means that if your family makes hundreds of thousands of dollars each year, they can probably afford to send you to a university. You probably don't need this scholarship. And honestly, and so that's half and half. So you met both roughly on a rubric scale, and you know, again, that's how you got into the school. Well, honestly, when you start applying for college scholarships, they work the same way. You know, on one end, they're going to look at your grades. They're going to look at, can you do it? Is this a valuable investment? And on the other half, they're going to look, do you need this? Or can your family just pay cash? And so those types of guidelines are revised yearly, generally. And they're also based on need. You know, in terms of food stamps, they're based on a basic need to survive. Now, as you can imagine, this data is very old. The poverty level in 2006 was set at $9,800. The poverty level today, somewhere around 15,000 or less. 15,000 or less for an individual's income. And then for a family of four, that number could actually be quite a bit higher, and you would still fit within the poverty guidelines. Now in 2006, under that guideline, there were roughly 37 million people in our country who were making less than $10,000 a year. Now let me throw another mix in this equation. In 2006, I made less than $10,000 that year. I worked part-time as a student and full-time in the summer, still made less than $10,000 that year. In fact, that same year I was paying rent and paying all of my bills except for a cell phone. I think my parents, we had a family plan, so that was like the one thing they took care of for me. I also didn't have medical insurance. I tore my ACL that same year. Ironically, it was a big year for me. Lots of things happened. It was neat. It was fun. But that part was really scary. Because I got really hurt and couldn't afford to fix it. Which is another reason I really appreciate having this surgery, because now I got really hurt and I got it fixed. That time I got really hurt and couldn't afford to get it fixed. I was below the poverty level. Now granted, I could have qualified for a number of programs, but I wouldn't have perhaps qualified for that surgery because potentially someone could have determined that I could live without it. Now, honestly, I wish I had pursued food stamps at that time, because as a poor college kid, it wasn't just a euphemism for me. I was an actual poor college kid, meaning working and still struggling financially. And had I pursued it, perhaps I would have qualified for food stamps. Now, the goal of this program is we believe as a society that no one should have to starve to death in this country. A country that makes more food than it needs. A country that exports food. Why should we have people who are food insecure, is the formal term, starving, in a country where we send food to other countries? So yes, we have plenty. And so we have the food stamp program. And food stamps are basically coupons today. It's a card. Like if you swipe a food stamp card at the line, no one knows that you've even used it. And another group I left out in our earlier discussion, victims of poverty. Who does it affect most severely? Children. Children are affected most severely. And again, the aim of food stamps is that even, you know, regardless of what situation the parents are in, are they working, are they not, are they decent people, are they not, the children are helpless. And so we have federal welfare programs as well. WIC, you know, and you see this on the milk, on the bread, on the cheese, on the butter, etc. WIC stands for Women, Infants, and Children. It's a program to help very young children get the basic necessities. There's also supplemental security income. And this can be a base income, financial assistance for those in need. And it can even be given out on an emergency basis, like the temporary assistance to needy families. In the 1990s, welfare to work began, more popularly known as workfare. This is a program that required welfare recipients to work in exchange for some of these benefits. And so welfare to work is something you learned about in American history. And then finally, the progressive income tax. The progressive income tax. It's a system of taxation where the wealthy pay a higher percentage of their income than do the poor, as opposed to a flat tax. So for example, the state income tax in North Carolina is a progressive income tax. The sales tax is a flat tax. And so in theory, the sales tax hits the poor with a higher degree of their discretionary income. So it actually taxes the poor more heavily than it taxes the rich, as opposed to a progressive income tax. Next, there's the earned income tax credit. See, what I want to get at is I don't want you to say, like, the government's doing nothing for people in my situation. In fact, the government's tried to do a lot. But many of these programs are underfunded. You know, like Bailey was saying, you know, many of these programs could do more. But they're hampered by politics. You know, they're hampered by people who don't want to pay more in taxes. But the Earned Income Tax Credit provides tax credits or cash assistance to those in need and helps about 20 million people annually. And so in terms of what is the best way to help someone, and I guess what I want to get at is that all of these have been implemented. We're working toward all of these different programs and solutions.